Meeting. Apologize, Laura, for getting ahead of you. Let me start over. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's spring meeting of the Metropolitan Area Planning or MAP Forum. And my name is Matt Hart, and I'm the Executive Director of the Capital Region Council of Governments. And we're very excited to host this year's spring virtual meeting. I'm joined by my colleagues at CROG, Rob Alois, Kara Radzins, and Laura Rosenbluth. And today's meeting, we're going to focus on regional activities related to reconnecting communities. Reconnecting communities will be our theme today. And as we know, it's a particular emphasis of the Federal Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, or the IIJA. We're thrilled that we have Connecticut's Department of Transportation Commissioner Garrett Ucolito here with us today. He's going to be providing his welcoming remarks and his thoughts on safety and other departmental priorities. I also appreciate that New Britain Mayor and CROG's Chair Aaron Stewart is here with us today, and I'm going to shortly ask her to offer her welcome and to introduce the commissioner. But first, we do need to quickly take care of some organizational matters before we get into our agenda. And we'll start with a roll call of MAP Forum members. And for purposes of the roll call, I only need to hear from one representative from each agency. And if you want to introduce the other members of your team, feel free, but you don't need to do that. So we'll start off with the Connecticut Metropolitan Council of Governments, MetroCOG. Anyone here today? You could just announce yourself, please. All right, we'll move on.
I'm sorry, this is Megan Sloan, Planning Director with MetroCOG, and Matt Holder should be joining soon.
Thank you so much, Megan. Welcome. I already introduced the Capital Region Council, the CROG team, Lehigh Valley Planning Commission.
Brian Height, I'm filling in for Becky Bradley, who's on vacation.
Great. Welcome to have you, Brian.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. And then we've got the Lower Connecticut River Valley Council of Governments.
Rob Harriman's here.
Good morning, Rob. Great to have you as well. And then we've got our colleagues from the Naugatuck Valley Council of Governments, NVCOG.
Good morning, Mark Nielsen, Assistant Director. We're also joined by several staff. Thank you.
Good morning, Mark. Next, we have our New York Metropolitan Transportation Council, NMTC.
Good morning, Matt. It's Adam Levine, along with Jerry Bogaz and about a half a dozen of our team from NMTC.
Excellent. Good morning, Adam. Next, we have the North Jersey Transportation Planning Authority.
Hey, good morning. This is Dave Barron from NJTPA, joined by several members of our team as well, a few of whom you'll be hearing from later in the meeting.
Excellent. Thank you, David. Next, we have the Orange County Transportation Council.
Hi, this is Stacey Butler. I'm filling in for Alan Sorensen. He had a conference today.
Good morning, Stacey, and welcome.
Thank you.
And then next, we have our South Central Regional Council Governments.
Hi, good morning. This is Rebecca Andrucci from South Central.
Good morning, Rebecca. And then last, but certainly not least, we have the Western Connecticut Council of Governments, WestCOG.
Good morning, Francis Pickering, Executive Director here for WestCOG.
Good morning, Francis. Okay, that completes our roll call. And I'm now going to turn to Mayor Stewart for her welcome and to introduce the commissioner. And after the commissioner's remarks, we will take questions from MAP Forum members and time permitting from the audience. So those of you who may have questions for the commissioner, if you could submit those via the webinar chat feature, and we can take them time permitting when we get to that stage of the agenda. And I'd now like to turn things over to the mayor. If you don't know Mayor Stewart, she's done a fabulous job representing her community for over a decade now, has done a lot of great work in the city of New Britain. We're thrilled to have her as the chair of our 40-member policy board. And I know she's got a great relationship with Commissioner Iacolito and is happy to introduce him. Mayor Stewart.
Thanks, Matt. Good morning, everybody. And thank you so much for being with us this morning. We're excited to join you all and look forward to hearing about the many projects and opportunities that will reconnect our communities. Just want to thank everybody for taking time out of your Friday. I know Fridays are very, very important, especially when the weather is nice, but thank you for taking some time to spend that with us this morning. As chairperson of the Capital Region Council of Governments, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Commissioner Garrett Iacolito, a friend, a trusted public servant, and truly an expert in this field. I was proud to offer my name as one of the many who testified in support of his nomination for the commissionership this past year. I've had the distinct pleasure of working with Commissioner Iacolito over the last decade in my time as mayor of the city of New Britain. And throughout that time, I found that he's been a dedicated public servant, a trusted ally, not just to the city of New Britain, but to the Capital Region, and a thoughtful individual with deep knowledge and understanding of all things transportation related. He's a true professional, keenly acute to detail, oftentimes to a fault, one of the strongest liaisons between municipalities and the state of Connecticut, especially helping us navigate the Department of Transportation world, which we all know can be oftentimes confusing and arduous. With 15 years of experience in transportation and infrastructure, his accomplishments become far too many to cite over the course of his career, but I can attest that I will always be personally grateful for Commissioner Iacolito for all the work he's done for the city of New Britain in making our high-reaching transit-oriented development and transportation enhancement goals a reality. He understands the value of working with local and regional leadership in finding creative ways to find government solutions to these problems. He also worked for OPM before, which was also a great help to us. We've been able to successfully navigate tens of millions of dollars worth of transportation projects in just the city of New Britain's downtown because of his help. Commissioner has an excellent reputation for maximizing efficiency while effectively adapting and responding to issues as they arise too. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce to you today, a Commissioner of Connecticut Department of Transportation, Garrett Iacolito. Hi, Garrett, you can pay me for that later.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. thank you for the kind words. Yes, I can be a little bit too attention to detail oriented. My staff tend to get frustrated with me. So let me share my screen. I think I will use that screen. That should work, right, Coffee? Mm-hmm. Okay, perfect. Okay, so share there. Okay, so thank you again. I'm Garrett Iacolito, the commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Transportation. So I know the topic today is focused on reconnecting communities. So for me and my past, the 5 months, 6 months as commissioner, my big focus has been safety in all of its form. Not only safety for those traveling on our roadways, but also the safety of our employees, public works employees, and that's something that is constantly on my mind. I'm constantly worried that I'm going to get that phone call that one of my colleagues was injured on the roadways in the work zone. So safety in all of its forms is something that we're intensely focused on. And that's where I believe that reconnecting our communities can help us improve safety for all users of our system. So today I'm going to walk through a little bit of our priority here at Connecticut DOT about what our priority or what our safety initiatives are and where we're going in the future and how we can use our MPO partners to help Connecticut get there. Perfect. Okay. So what is the Connecticut DOT or CONDOT or CTDOT, whatever we call ourselves? We own, construct, maintain our infrastructure across Connecticut. in partnership with our municipal governments. 169 towns and cities make up the great state of Connecticut, and we work with all of them to ensure that our roadways, our railroads, our buses are all in working order, and that it's a safe and efficient transportation system. We also have two river ferries that cross the beautiful Connecticut River. So if you've never taken them, make sure to get on board. One of them is the longest running ferry in the nation, from Rocky Hill to Glastonbury. So we, like I said, we work to make sure people get where they need to go safely, efficiently, no matter what form of transportation they're using, whether they're riding in the car, walking on the sidewalk, taking their bike, taking a train or a bus. If they fly or take a ferry across Long Island Sound, that's not us, but otherwise it involves us. So my focus when I came into Connecticut DOT, I told my team and I told the legislature there were three things: safety, accessibility, and sustainability. Those were the two, the three big focus areas that I wanted to focus on in my term as commissioner. Safety, like I already talked about, safety in all of its forms. Accessibility to me means ensuring that people can get to where they need to go efficiently and in a safe manner. But also accessibility means opening up opportunity for individuals. So providing them with more economic mobility, if you provide them with greater access to transportation services or a safer way to get to where they need to go, they can access more jobs, more education opportunities, more healthcare, and more leisure activities. Sustainability for me is two parts. It's both environmental sustainability as well as fiscal sustainability, ensuring that we are advancing the cleanest transportation system we can, but also one that is sustainable, able to be maintained, and reducing long-term costs for maintenance. And we're able to focus on these areas in large part because of the new federal infrastructure bill, with nearly 40% more funding coming to Connecticut as part of that. It means that we can work with all of our local government partners, our MPOs, to get more done for the residents of Connecticut. Unfortunately, we, over the past 3.5 years, we have seen changes on our roadways. So while the infrastructure bill has come into effect, while new funding is coming to Connecticut, we have seen an increase in dangerous behavior on our roadways. We have intense speeding, huge uptick in distractions inside the vehicle, a continuous threat of impairment on our roadways, both alcohol and drug impairment. And all of those combined are leading to a high rate of crashes and a record level of fatalities. So last year in 2022, we had 386 fatalities on our roadways, which was the highest in nearly three decades. There, these numbers here, so you can see the bottom shows the historic preliminary year in numbers. Those numbers are a little different from what we keep internally. Those represent the federal reported stats. So 369 numbers there, 302 in 2021, and 299 in 2020. But on the top bar, you see the numbers as of June 1st. So we are just pacing a little bit behind last year, but it changes every week. 2 weeks ago, we were outpacing last year. So we are not trending in the right direction in our state. We continue to have a significant number of fatalities on our roadways. And fatalities are just one part of the equation. It also is serious injuries. There's an economic cost to these crashes. Billions of dollars are wasted every single year due to avoidable crashes that could have been prevented, taking people out of work, making them pay more for their insurance, making them pay more for health care, things that they should not have to put onto their household budget. Here you see stats on the types of fatals, bike, pedestrian, passengers and drivers, and motorcycles. We have continued to see pedestrian fatalities increase in our state. It is not just in Connecticut, it's a national problem. but it is very concerning. And I think that's one area where a focus on reconnecting communities really can help us get out of the mindset and the culture of our communities are being designed to get vehicles as quickly as possible through those communities. If we can reconnect those, stitch it back together, make it safer to walk and bike to where you need to go, it makes our cities more lively and it makes it safer for everyone using the system. Okay. So at the beginning, I talked about safety in all of its forms, both for the users of the system as well as for the workers. So two years ago, we were granted approval for a pilot program for work zone speed cameras. So this is something that is currently in place in Connecticut. We are allowed to do up to 3 locations at one time. We are doing both highway construction work zones as well as maintenance work zones that DOT staff are working in because it's extremely unsafe for our employees, for construction workers, for laborers, for inspectors to be out there on the side of the road with vehicles traveling the speeds they're going and the driving like they are driving today. So we are doing a huge, robust media campaign focused on this issue. We have TV ads, social media, as well as radio ads focused on this. This is not intended to as a gotcha thing. We have multiple signs up, 2 signs advance of the speed cameras to ensure that people know. We put the locations on the internet before they go live that day. And anyone who's using GPS, if they're using Waze or Google Maps, they're probably getting that alert that there is a speed camera ahead. So it's really intended to ensure that people slow down through those work zones to ensure that those workers get home at night because they have families at home, they have loved ones at home, they have pets at home. And if they don't make it home at night, that's on those who are driving through that work zone unsafely in a selfish and reckless behavior. Impairment is a big issue. So in Connecticut, we have a lot of other campaigns going on. So what you're seeing here is an ad campaign about cannabis. So when Connecticut legalized cannabis in our state, Connecticut DOT was at the table with legislators and with the governor's office. And we talked a lot about the behavioral and education campaign that we need to do in advance of cannabis being legalized. Not only that, but we worked to do a lot of changes to the DUI and impairment statutes and providing law enforcement with more tools. But on the education campaign, this is an example of one of the ads that we ran to make people aware that you're not safer when you are high with cannabis. You need to be careful behind the wheel. You don't get behind the wheel after using pot. And that's something that is going to have to be continuously reinforced. So we started these ad campaigns on TV, radio, internet, social media placements. And we started that well before cannabis was legalized. We're continuing to run these. The legislature and the governor actually provided us with a portion of the sales tax from cannabis to the DOT to be able to do ad campaigns like this. And we're also doing green labs. So where we will, in a controlled environment, get individuals, volunteers high and have law enforcement learn how to test for impairment on those individuals. But you see on the side there's other ad campaigns focused on safety. We're doing the Know Your Zone one, which I just talked about before. One Wrong Move, which is wrong way driving in Connecticut. We saw a 500% increase in wrong way driving crashes last year, 13 crashes, 23 fatalities. Drive sober, get pulled over, click it or ticket. And then Look, Then Lock, which is focused on your back seat. You know, we have seen nationally an increase of people who accidentally leave their children in the back seat in warm months. So that's an ad campaign that we work with NHTSA and Connecticut Children's Medical Center on those campaigns. Pedestrian safety, huge focus area for us. But we're not only focused on raising awareness and education, which is part of what falls under the NHTSA umbrella, behavioral change, we're focused on the infrastructure change as well. That's a longer term change. It's going to take us years to address all the infrastructure in our state that we need to address to make it safer for individuals. It's going to require us to continue to work with our partners at the MPO and local level. But we need to continue to make these changes. And there's lots of things we can be doing. A lot of them are visible. Many of them are not. And so there are many things out there like centerline rumble strips. If that can help someone from crossing the center line, keep them in their lane so that they don't actually have a head-on collision on some of the many roads we have in Connecticut where they're windy, curvy, dark in a lot of our rural areas. Those centerline rumble strips will wake you up and you'll re-center yourself in your lane. One of the things that I find a lot of fun talking about are things like roundabouts, which is new to Connecticut. People get sometimes a little flustered coming into them, and we need to do a lot of education about how to use a roundabout, but they are one of the best tools in our toolbox to improve the safety at an intersection. If you convert a four-way stop to a roundabout, you reduce serious crashes, you reduce all crashes, you reduce injuries, you reduce emissions. So it's a great way to address multiple benefits for the transportation system. High friction surface treatments, something that people probably don't know is there, but it stops the vehicles from exiting the roadway, which will keep the driver safe. RRFBs, rapid rectangular flashing beacons at crosswalks around the state, trying to install more of those, better signage, new traffic signals, all of that is very visible, noticeable for the traveling public. And that's the intent, right? To keep them focused on what's coming up ahead. And one thing that I've been really working really closely with our traffic engineering team on is in moving forward with converting a lot of our crosswalks and intersections to concurrent greens with leading pedestrian intervals. So get that pedestrian a few second head start to get into the crosswalk before a vehicle is given the green light and is trying to take a red a right turn or a left turn, right? So that way, too often what we've seen is the right hook or the left hook where a pedestrian is hit because the driver says they didn't see the pedestrian in that crosswalk. Well, if we give that pedestrian a few second head start to get in there, that's going to protect them. And we know nationwide it is a huge safety measure, a huge safety benefit. So this session at the Capitol has been really exciting. A lot has happened. And there's a lot to do before June 7th when we have CNADA when it concludes. But there's a whole host of bills pending that are going to improve safety. There's a whole host of bills that have not made it across and will not make it across the finish line. But we had a great opportunity to work with the Vision Zero Council, statewide Vision Zero Council, to advance a whole package of initiatives. Many of them are still alive past the House chamber. So that's a great opportunity for us to use automated traffic enforcement and focus on other safety improvements like having DOT have an intersection control evaluation policy, but also focus on safe routes to schools, advancing education in our schools about safe use of our transportation system. Other parts did not make it through, such as motorcycle helmets, as well as open containers. Both of those were dropped from the Vision Zero bill. One of my big pushes here has been to focus on reducing our BAC level in Connecticut to 0.05. The data is clear. You look at the NHTSA report, you look at what happened in Utah, NTSB is very focused on this. If you lower the BAC to 0.05, it improves safety on the roadways. It does not impact sales or tourism at all. And if you look at Europe, essentially every nation in Europe is 0.05 or below because it changes the culture. It encourages individuals to take stock of their behavior plan for a ride home, plan for a designated driver, plan to use public transit. And it's worked internationally, and it's worked in Utah. And I'm hopeful that in the future, we'll reignite this conversation here in Connecticut. And one other bill that has moved through is the wrong way driving bill. As many people from Connecticut know, a state legislator was killed in a horrific wrong way driving crash earlier this year. This bill would double down on the investments that Connecticut is making on improving flashing lights at ramps that will detect someone going the wrong way up that ramp, as well as testing other implementation opportunities to improve safety at those ramps. So, talked a lot about what Connecticut's doing or Connecticut DOT is doing, but what we do know is that everyone at every MPO, everyone at the state agency, everyone in federal government, US DOT, and everyone in local government, in law enforcement, in the legislature plays a part in safety, and we all need to work together. We need to center safety in our conversations. We need to ensure that it's not just focused on getting from A to B as quickly as possible, but it's getting people as safely as possible to where they need to go in the most efficient manner. So that's what we need to start focusing on, and the opportunity to reconnect communities and make investments in our communities to undo the damage that has been done in the past is a great opportunity to improve safety while we undo that damage. So we know that our partners at the local level often struggle to come up with the funding that they need to make the investments that they know they want. They know their cities and towns best. So we have a whole host of different programs that we are going to continue to work with our partners on. You see there's as my colleague Coffee calls it, alphabet soup of programs. But I'm excited by many by them. And one of them I'm really passionate about is the Community Connectivity Grant Program. This is one that, you know, I like to say that the USDOT copied us when they rolled out Safe Streets for All, because we had ours first, but it is intended to help local governments build out their sidewalks, their bike lanes, new, safer intersections in local communities. We've awarded $38 million to date. We have more funding out there today for ANOFO for towns to apply for. And the budget actually has two more years worth of funding for us. So I'm really excited to continue that program for two more years. Some great projects there. This one you see in your screen is actually in Stamford, Boxer Square. That is a huge, great program, and it's very popular. A new program we're rolling out is called TRIP, Transportation Rural Improvement Program. We have a program in Connecticut called LOTSIP, where there's a portion of funds that go to the MPOs to help administer and determine which projects to fund. TRIP is going to be a similar program for our rural communities that don't have a lot of those federally eligible roadways. So they'll be able to use these state funds to improve roadways, bridges, and other infrastructure. But you know, we know that there's a lot of opportunity out there for local governments and for our regional partners to compete for at the national level with Safe Streets for All and other competitive discretionary grants. Safe Streets for All, us at the state DOT are not eligible for. So we're really excited that there were multiple winners in Connecticut during the last round. I know there's another round opportunity, and there will be multiple rounds of opportunity coming up. So excited to support our regional partners in making those safety investments on their roadways. So with that, I just want to close and, you know, thank you for inviting me to give me an opportunity to talk about safety here in Connecticut, and how I think we can all work together to center that in our discussion every single day. We need everyone at our MPOs to be our partners and help us on that local and regional level to improve safety. And I welcome any questions if we have time, Matt.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. Really appreciate you sharing this good information about the great work that you and the department are doing, as well as those sobering statistics that those of us in the field are, you know, very familiar with and very troubled by. So we do have time to take a few questions here. I'm going to start off with panelists and members. If you want to raise your hand and I can call on you. Let's start off with Mark Nielsen.
Good morning, Commissioner. Thank you for your remarks. We're looking forward to working with you on safety. I guess I'm very excited about the legislation that's moving through right now regarding the cameras or the ability to put cameras along certain areas in high crash locations, high pedestrian zones. As you may know, the mayor of the chairman of my board is Mayor O'Leary of Waterbury, and he's very excited about this. And we're going to be working with him quite a bit. Hopefully this legislation will pass this week. The one question I did have, you talked about safety for bicyclists and pedestrians, and I think one of the things we've been sort of concerned with is the increased use of e-bikes and e-scooters. It's opening that micro mobility to a lot more people. Are you sort of concerned, or are you thinking how we can try to better protect, this increasing alternative mode, as it were? Because again, it's a little bit different, a lot of our streets can't accommodate, the e-bikes and the e-scooters. I was just curious if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, our streets have to accommodate them. A bike, whether it's an e-bike or a regular bike, has every right to be on the roadway. So we need to ensure that we can accommodate them. And if we can do things like widen the shoulders to provide and do some road diets, reduce the lane widths for places that we can't go and put a bike lane in, then that's the opportunity we need to go forward with. We are pushing ourselves here internally at the DOT. We're looking at a lot of changes that we're hopefully going to be rolling out in the next couple months that we'll be coming to talk to all of our MPO partners about related to controlling criteria for all of our projects. We're going to make some changes to that, as well as changing our complete streets policy. I lived in DC for over a decade combined, lived in Boston for several years. When I lived in DC, the e-bikes and e-scooters were plentiful. I used it multiple times a week to get where I need to go. Part of that was the infrastructure was slow to catch up to the e-bikes and the e-scooters. And so I think it is going to be a conversation in education, though, where we need to ensure that people are using them safely and not impacting individuals who are walking on the sidewalk or individuals with mobility impairment or vision impairments who may not hear them or see them coming on that sidewalk. We need to ensure that they're safely using the infrastructure we have today and begin to retrofit the infrastructure to accommodate all forms of bikes and scooters as it advances.
Yeah, I think that is one of the main issues with e-bikes and e-scooters. The speed differential between somebody just walking or, riding slowly on a manual powered bike, that's where we start having some concerns, that speed differential. And like you said, making sure that people just know how to ride and to ride considerately, along, understand that you're not the only person on the road. So thank you.
Thank you, Mark, for your good question. And thank you, Commissioner, for your response there. Any other questions for the commissioner? Okay, there are two questions in the chat. Laura, can you read the first one, please?
Sure. Joseph would like to know, too, that answer would the same be true for skateboards and inline skates?
So I don't know what the vehicular laws are with skateboards or inline skates. So I will plead ignorance on DMV controls vehicles and what vehicles are allowed on the roadway. So I will plead ignorance on that. But if someone's using it, I want to make sure they're safe, no matter whether they are doing it in accordance with the local ordinance or not. I want to make sure that nothing happens to them. So we need to make sure that when I was growing up and rode my skateboard, I was usually on the sidewalk. I don't know if that was the correct ordinance in Torrington. I probably was doing it inappropriately, but that's where I felt safe doing it.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I think that concludes the questions in the chat. The others are more statements. At least that's my interpretation of them. Commissioner, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And on a personal note, I really appreciate the fact that you've emerged as a thought leader nationwide and that you're very much in touch with what's happening around the nation, you know, and working to bring best practices here to our state. And on behalf of our state's COGS and MPOs, we really appreciate the excellent working relationship we have with you and with the members of your team. You know, what I've heard from my colleagues who've been working in this space much longer than I have is that it's never been better. It's never been better. And that's a testament to you and the great work of your team. So thank you so much for joining us here today. You're certainly welcome to stay, but we understand you're a very busy person. And if you need to leave today's meeting, please feel free. Thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent. Okay, so we're now going to move forward to the next items on our agenda, to the regional issues section. And we're really pleased today to have presentations on two regional projects that really can help highlight the theme of today's meeting on reconnecting communities. And if you're not familiar with Reconnecting Communities, that program under the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, really, it's the first ever federal program that's dedicated to reconnecting communities, as the commissioner discussed, that have been previously cut off from economic opportunities, other opportunities by transportation infrastructure. And the funding under this program supports planning grants, capital construction grants, technical assistance to restore community connectivity through the removal, retrofit, mitigation, or replacement of eligible infrastructure under the NOFO. So after these presentations, we're going to be taking questions from our audience, from starting off again, as we did previously, with our members, and then time permitting, from the general audience. And again, audience members can submit questions via the webinar chat feature. So the two initiatives we're going to talk about today, first is the Greater Hartford Mobility Study, which those of us who work here at CROG are particularly excited about. And Christian Nielsen and Maresh Kaur, and Maresh, I hope I'm pronouncing your last name correctly, from AECOM, they're going to take the lead. And then secondly, we're going to talk about a great project in the western part of our state that involves Route 8. And our colleagues, Mark Nielsen and Matt Fulda, will handle that presentation. So starting off with Christian and Maresh, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. Just give me a moment to find the right screen as we go here. My name is Christian Nielsen. I'm part of the consultant team, along with Maya Resch, both from AECOM, and we've been working with the department on the Greater Hartford Mobility Plan over the last two years. I know Maya Resch, I believe, has had involvement before that when it was kind of in its infancy as part of some of the I-84 Hartford work that probably many folks on the call remember. And this is kind of the rebirth and expansion of that project. So it's a PEL study, which is a planning environmental linkages study, which kind of helps to kind of accelerate the process from alternatives scoring to implementation and get things ready for kind of the environmental review to kind of streamline a lot of those processes. It was conducted in two phases, with the first phase being kind of an existing conditions, an alternative development phase where we reviewed ongoing studies, solicited ideas from members of the public, and kind of created what we call the universe of alternatives, which was 160 plus or minus different ideas that cover bike, ped, highway, rail, bus, all sorts of different alternatives that then went through an initial screening phase and then were moved into phase two. If they passed that, where they went through a more in-depth assessment and kind of went into the scenario planning tool, which is kind of the model alternatives piece of that, kind of score and see how they affect a lot of kind of some of the key performance indicators that we were using, and then kind of move those into an implementation plan and kind of the Pell close out kind of in the fall of 2023, as you can kind of see. So hopefully within the next couple weeks to month and a half, there'll be another round of public rollout, public engagement, where we'll be sharing kind of the final ideas, the final alternatives, and soliciting feedback and sharing everything that we've developed over the last couple years. As I kind of alluded to, this is a little bit of kind of a rebirth of the I-84 Harper project, kind of a recognition that the problems that project was trying to address were a lot broader than kind of the scope allowed. And it's kind of been expanded to kind of address all different types of mobility needs across the broader Hartford region, and kind of improve the safety, as the commissioner was touching on, the accessibility, the reliability, and kind of address some of the infrastructure constraints that basically lead to kind of a bisection of a lot of these different corridors in and around Hartford from kind of a lot of the interstate work that went on in the 1960s and 70s, which is kind of a key focus of the Reconnecting Communities grant program, and kind of a really awesome outcome to pursue with this project is trying to move away from strict highway congestion improvements, but also kind of make the bike and pedestrian and the system more efficient for all of its users and more equitable for all of its users. So as I noted, today we're going to be focusing mostly on kind of the core piece in downtown Hartford and kind of the role of the different highway pieces that kind of encapsulate the city and kind of leading to kind of some inequities, high levels of congestion and efficiencies, and kind of some of those problems that the program will help kind of reconnect. But I just want to emphasize that the program is absolutely regional and includes a lot of ideas and initiatives that spread across the kind of entire region that you kind of see highlighted by this little blue border here. And it's a big vision. So this is downtown Hartford. I'm sure as most everyone's aware, with 84 kind of coming through and the rail line coming through in this top left corner, 91 kind of coming down through the middle, and then kind of 84 and Route 2 over in East Hartford. And these roadways often are points of civic congestion during key commuting hours, and have an ideal geometries that kind of exacerbate some of the safety and the congestion issues. And initially I-84 Hartford was intended to mainly focus on this, but as we've talked about, the whole kind of initiative and vision has expanded to focus more broadly on the greater Hartford region and how these different pieces can help addressing these different pieces kind of help the communities more broadly. So I-84 Hartford kind of bisects the Asylum Hill and the Frog Hollow neighborhoods. The viaduct was kind of built in the late 60s to 1970-ish and cut those neighborhoods in half and act as kind of a major accessibility barrier. This photo was on the cover of an FHWA report from that era that was almost a bit of an admittance of an oopsie right after it was built, that this may not be the best solution for the city, and leads to kind of generating and perpetuating a lot of kind of inequities in access and segregating the neighborhoods in and around Hartford. Similar thing, as we come around between the downtown and what we call the downtown north neighborhoods, In this other historic photo, you can kind of see some houses at the very top that are being bisected by this by 84 and the major highway, which is kind of in a cut there. And this was attempted to be rectified kind of later on with this large capping, but it didn't exactly achieve the vision that it was hoped to, and now kind of is a lot of parking, and we have the yard goats are kind of over in that area. So starting to get more, but still kind of just a major barrier and not the kind of dense connected development that we would prefer to see in that area. Similarly, kind of between the Clay Arsenal and downtown North neighborhoods, you have kind of the rail line that cuts across kind of in through this area that kind of creates a lot of dead space. Kind of the narrative kind of flows around as you look at all these assets where they're basically cutting through the neighborhoods and kind of creating a disjointed patchwork of neighborhoods that aren't readily connected and don't necessarily feel the safest for people walking or biking in and around the city. Here we have kind of 91 coming down along the highway and the 91-84 interchange. The interchange wasn't necessarily supposed to be here. There was plans for a Bushnell Park kind of highway that thankfully never were built, but you have this kind of interchange here with very, very tight geometry that causes a lot of congestion in the area. It's possibly kind of one of the most constrained pieces of highway infrastructure in the state, causing a lot of issues and kind of blocking off access from the river. This kind of just shows a side profile kind of where the highway's up on the viaduct here, and you have this freight rail line that winds its way around as well, kind of blocking off access from the city to the river. And you're kind of either up above it here, or you have to be all the way down on the other side below, but there's limited access between those points. Similar story as we progress further down, where you have the Whitehead Highway coming off of 91, which is limited access, has very high speeds as it kind of cuts directly down into Hartford and Pulaski Circle, which has a not optimized design and kind of leads to a lot of safety issues and isn't necessarily designed really to accommodate cyclists or pedestrians well, especially with the speeds that people are coming off of the Whitehead Highway at. A little further down, this photo is kind of showing the Colt building, which is a proposed national park, and kind of the lack of connectivity between what is hopefully soon going to be a national park and kind of the river, this disjointed connection between different neighborhoods, different pieces of the city and the river, perpetuated by the highway infrastructure. And then the last piece is kind of the Route 284 Mixmaster, which is a large sprawling interchange that kind of eats up a lot of land, and it doesn't efficiently move people between the different highway systems and causes its own issues. And so a lot of the central focus within the study core is kind of addressing these four kind of major pieces of highway infrastructure and how they kind of bisect the community, and kind of working to rectify that and improve things both from highway efficiency perspective, but then also definitely from a local road and a bike and pedestrian safety perspective. In terms of kind of the timing, this is kind of the future view of our process. So as we noted earlier, kind of closing out our Pell study this fall, and then moving a couple of the kind of major pieces into NEPA within the next couple years for kind of design and construction timeline in the 2030s, with both early action and midterm projects peppered in to hopefully get some early and midterm wins and kind of address some of the smaller components that were developed as part of the Greater Hartford Mobility Study. And here's a quick little snapshot of a couple of those that are in and around the Hartford area, including Trident, Albany Ave, the Riverlink, and Pulaski, which are just a few pieces that will focus on a lot of times both improving the bike and pedestrian pieces, but also kind of the safety of all roadway users. With that, I can pass it back to Matt or whoever else, or if we're doing questions now, or I think you mentioned later, correct?
Yes, thank you so much, Christian. Yep. Unless you or Marish have anything else you want to comment on right now, I think you're good. So I'd like to turn to Mark and to Matt Falda to present their project, and then we'll have a Q&A on both.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Matt. Let me get this set up. All right, thank you again. My name is Mark Nielsen. I'm with the Naugatuck Valley Council of Governments. I'm here with Matt Falda, who's the executive director at MetroCog. Let me start this at the beginning. All right, there we go. Apologize for that. So anyway, we're going to be talking about a project concept that the MetroCog and NVCog have been working on. Matt's going to be talking a little bit about the reconnecting community issues in the Bridgeport region, and I'm going to be focusing in on the Naugatuck Valley and the Waterbury area. Just want to give a little bit of background of the area we're talking about. Route 8 is a expressway that runs from downtown Bridgeport up to Winsted, which is in the Northwest Hills part of Connecticut. Extends for 58 miles and has that major interchange with I-95, Route 15, which is the Merritt Parkway, and then I-84. And it passes through 15 cities and towns, and it replaced a series of local roads, two-lane roads that served a lot of times as the main street and main access points for a lot of the cities and towns through which it passed. It was built over a course of 35 years, with the first expressway section completed in 1951 and the last one in 1982. So it was built in starts and stops, and had sections that were an expressway that fed into a two-lane road. And the volumes on it are fairly high. Downtown Bridgeport, where it intersects with interchange with 95, has over 93,000 vehicles a day. Near the Waterbury Mixmaster with I-84, it's closer to 59,000, and then slowly decreases as you head north. Just want to talk a little bit about the communities through which it passes. These are former industrial cities, that were small, compact. They're very walkable. People lived and worked in that same area. These downtowns have a lot of interesting architecture that's still in place. Historically, these were the centers of activity. They're very vibrant. People lived and worked and socialized in the downtowns. When the highway was built, it sort of changed a lot of things. The economy was affected by the expressway because it provided greater access and mobility. The economies were changing from industrial to more social services and things like that. So there are a lot of factors that led to sort of the economic downturn of these areas, but the expressway definitely was one of the factors. The highway itself created barriers. It limited access to Naugatuck River. Because it did go through a lot of the downtown areas, instead of having it at sort of ground level, they built elevated sections. And like I said, at the interchange with I-95 and Bridgeport, it really split the what's called the Hollow neighborhood and the West End neighborhoods from downtown Bridgeport. You know, people just couldn't just walk from those neighborhoods right to the downtown area. It was basically a forced to either drive or not go there. The 84 Route 8 interchange, is a multi-level stack structured and basically divided the city into four quadrants. It's a massive interchange with multiple on and off ramps that really create an intimidating space underneath. So what we were talking about, reconnecting options. And as Matt Hart had indicated, the infrastructure bill had the grant proposal for reconnecting communities. We put together a multi-regional application between MetroCOG, NVCOG, and Northwest Hills COG to look at the entire highway from the beginning in Bridgeport to its end in Winstead. We wanted to take this multi-regional approach so that we could really identify what's going on. We wanted to assess current conditions. We wanted to evaluate the historic context through which the highway passes, so we have a better understanding of what the impact of the highway has been. We are going to have a very proactive public engagement and outreach program. And the idea was we were going to develop a toolkit for strategies and actions. This was going to be a planning study. Even though the Reconnecting Communities pilot program does include construction, we understand that the cost of either relocating the structures or burying them or doing something is probably beyond the financial capabilities of the federal government even or the state. So we're looking at how we could soften the areas underneath the highways and make them more walkable, more pedestrian bike friendly. The idea was to develop a toolkit that would identify different strategies and actions that we could implement at the local level. Unfortunately, the application was not awarded, but we do plan to refine the application to some degree and then resubmit this round of funding. What we may do is focus more on the key downtown areas that were mostly impacted by the Route 8. With that, I want to turn it over to Matt Fulda, who's going to talk a little bit about the impacts and the options for the downtown Bridgeport area.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. And thank you all for the opportunity to talk here. So as Mark said, we collaborated very closely with Naugatuck Valley COG on the application for the Reconnect Communities for the Route 8 corridor. As you can see, the 8 corridor is the kind of the north-south corridor here. This is the 95 corridor that runs east to west through the city of Bridgeport. Both have created significant challenges throughout the city in regards to connectivity between neighborhoods. You can see this is the Hollow section that Mark referred to previously to the west of the Route 8 25 connector. The downtown Bridgeport is here. You have the south end of Bridgeport over here. This is now Steel Point development right off of 95 here, which was a previously historically very industrial. But you can see the scale and the magnitude of the infrastructure there really does create a problem for the entire city moving from neighborhood, from downtown to the Hollow, from downtown to the east side and to the east end, even from downtown to the south end with the, you have 95, but you also have the rail viaduct that runs through 95 and down through the south end as well. So there's a lot of connectivity issues that exist within the city of Bridgeport. The construction of these two interstates or the limited access highway and Interstate 95 did remove a number of existing residential developments within the city and further bifurcated a lot of the city from one another. And so one of the things that we wanted to look at is finding ways that might be able to accommodate better pedestrian bicycle movement between the various neighborhoods of the city to try to energize and catalyze the downtown area while also lifting up the development opportunities in other parts of the city. We you know, that we had looked initially at potentially options to cover part of the 825 connector in the downtown Bridgeport area. Some of the topography would allow for that, but there are a lot of factors that go into kind of actually implementing that. So through this planning work, we were hoping to kind of identify, as Mark said previously, a tool set of potential options that we might be able to implement at various interchanges to better accommodate connectivity between pedestrians, bicycles throughout the downtown area of Bridgeport. Go to the next slide, Mark. So you can see here we have the 825 connector on this picture here is depressed. So it's underneath the grade of the roads to its west. You do have a couple bridges that go over overpasses that go over the connector, connecting that hollow area on the west side or the left side of that picture with the downtown and municipal administrative buildings on the right-hand side of that picture or the east side of the connector. And while they do exist, those bridges do exist, they are not very pedestrian friendly. They're not very bike friendly. There's not a lot of connectivity on either side of them to address some of those issues that people have kind of navigating from the west side of the connector to the east side. So we're really looking at how and when we could be able to provide alternatives for some of these configurations that would have reduced some of the barriers that are currently present to people and themselves being able to move back and forth across that 825 connector, that limited access highway that has created a barrier throughout all of the downtown area of Bridgeport. Next slide, Mark. And so as I mentioned in the beginning, we also, MetroCog applied for a Reconnecting Communities grant as well, planning grant. Unfortunately, we were not successful either, but we are looking to resubmit for the next round. And this one was, our grant was focusing specifically on the I-95 corridor through the east end of Bridgeport. As you saw from the first picture of downtown, you do have 95 and the 825 connector that kind of bisect the city in a number of different ways. You can see the right of way here on the bottom picture on the left hand side. That's the right of way for 95, and the area underneath it is obviously pre the interstate being built. So you can see that the interstate right of way did kind of go right through the middle of an existing neighborhood, a pretty vibrant neighborhood that was a lot of working class homes for people that were working in the various industrial activities that were happening in Bridgeport in the early to mid 1900s before that kind of industrial activity started to fade away. So you can see the displacement of a number of residential homes and really the displacement of the community. You have 95 there, which creates a significant barrier moving north-south across the East End. The East End is one of the most historically disadvantaged census tracts and disadvantaged neighborhoods, both in the city of Bridgeport and the state of Connecticut. Has very high unemployment, very low median incomes, and a high minority population. And we're trying to look at ways that we could better connect the East End to the East Side, which is where that Steel Point development is, that has the Bass Pro Shops and a number of other retail opportunities that are being developed, as well as a significant residential opportunity on the east on Steel Point there to the west of this picture. So our planning grant was really looking at how could we potentially provide better connectivity and connections between the East End and the rest of the city. Basically, the raised highway structures really do kind of cut off a lot of the East End, both from a physical perspective, but also from a visual perspective. The way the interstate is situated, you can see here on this next slide, thank you, Mark, I was gonna ask you to move it. it is elevated, so you have these very high embankments that run along 95. You can see someone walking here, and there's really no visual connection to the rest of the city when you're in this part of the East End. And then you do have one underpass here that's a kind of a side street that does get you to the other side of 95, but as you can see that bottom picture there, it's not very hospitable to bikes or pedestrians. It has a number of safety issues, and it's not somewhere that people would willingly or wantingly try to move themselves from the East End to the rest of the city. So we were hoping to kind of take a very holistic, and we worked with Connecticut DOT on our application and on their letter of support for this, really look at the entire area and figure out how we could best accommodate all the users and create those better connection points, both from a physical perspective as well as a visual perspective. So that's really what we're hoping to resubmit next time for this part of the city, as well as supporting Naugatuck Valley on their application for that 825 corridor as well. You know, next slide, Mark.
Okay, thanks, Matt. And I just want to briefly go through some of the issues that we're facing in the Naugatuck Valley. Again, we just wanted to show some examples of how the highway has sort of split communities, disrupted the area. And you know, this is downtown Seymour. And again, the problem here was, again, the highway was not located outside the downtown. It was actually went through it. And because they didn't want to purchase the land to actually, you know, take over the downtown, it was elevated. And it's there's really a long viaduct that goes along the north edge of the downtown area. And it just creates this barrier that is very hard to navigate. And the downtown or historic downtown is on the sort of the south side of the viaduct. But there's a commercial area that's along Bank Street, which is Route 67, that you know people really can't access because of they have to navigate this large interchange, not interchange, but viaduct. One thing we have done with working with this with the town is a short section of a multi-use trail was built connecting the Route 67 to the downtown area. So it runs right along one of the on-ramps to the expressway. So it does provide some alternative access between the two areas, but it's limited right now. We need to do more in the downtown area to provide the pedestrian amenities. This is downtown Naugatuck. Again, the borough was divided by not just Route 8, but the Waterbury Rail Line, as well as the Naugatuck River. The area to sort of the north of the upper part of the slide, picture on the top, is what's called Union City. On the west side of the river is the downtown area. And as you can see, the two areas are divided. And the borough and the mayor are very interested in trying to reconnect these two areas. And again, you can see how the overpass just just prevents any kind of access between the two areas. Waterbury, again, very similar situation. The construction slide at the top is showing the large swath that was put through. This is actually the Brooklyn neighborhood area of Waterbury. It basically just divided it in half. And as you can see, the elevated section with these embankments, really cut off the two sides. And there's no very limited access between the two areas. And then we have the Waterbury I-84 Route 8 interchange. This is multi-level, it's a stack structure, and it is probably the most imposing visual site within the city. Everybody sees it, and that's when you come to downtown Waterbury, this is what you see, and this is your impression of the downtown area. It makes it very unattractive, and it makes it very difficult for people to sort of be attracted to the downtown area. This is referred to as the mixed master as well because of the numerous on and off ramps, some of which have left-hand exits that create a lot of issues. And the areas under the stacks, it's desolate, it's uninviting. They do have sidewalks, but no one's ever going to walk there because it's just not it's very imposing. And so we need to do something about that. Similar to the Hartford Mobility Study, CTDOT in conjunction with HNTB Consultants is working on another Pell study. It's looking at the mixmaster, the interchange itself. The structure is getting close to 50 years old. It's become deficient, structurally unsound. And as part of the Pell study, they're taking a fresh look at the interchange and how to advance it into a design. And again, it's an infrastructure improvement. So they are focusing on the structure itself, the geometric issues, safety issues. But the good news is that they're also looking at the urban design concepts underneath the interchange to try to reconnect the communities that have been split by the highway, and looking at potential streetscape enhancements. So we're not going to replace the the interchange. You know, there had been some thought very early on about destacking the highway, but that wasn't going to be really any better for pedestrian safety enhancements, because it was just going to basically double the width of the swath of the highways going through the city. So the stack structure is likely to remain, but we got to figure out how best to accommodate pedestrians underneath that facility. And so these are some concepts that, you know, are being presented in the Pell study that the DOT and HNTV are working on. We feel that these are very good approaches that can be used in other parts of, you know, along the corridor. You know, it's the idea of creating parks and greenways to open up the space underneath the structures. You know, this would create kinetic, connective fabric between neighborhoods and hopefully enliven the spaces that are pretty much unapproachable now. Would say that the region and the communities along Route 8 are working on the Naugatuck River Greenway Trail Project. It's a 44-mile trail that would run basically parallel to the Naugatuck River, and in that case, along Route 8. And the Greenway would provide sort of a mobility alternative for people, and again, help people navigate, you know, the elevated structures of Route 8. And, you know, again, continuing with some of the concepts for this urban design approach, you know, again, the idea is, you know, accommodate all users. We want to make these complete streets. We want to create the safe active routes so that, you know, people, you know, feel that they can use, you know, navigate underneath the structure safely, and, you know, don't feel, you know, in an unsafe situation. As Matt indicated earlier on Route 8 in downtown Bridgeport, yeah, there is a possibility that we could cap, you know, some of the depressed sections in the city to try to create some park spaces. Yeah, and part of this study that we're looking at conducting, we want to identify what are the feasible alternatives. So it's a work in process. Like I said, we are going to be resubmitting the application, and hopefully this time will be successful. But and the idea is we may focus in on a few key areas, but we hope to create a toolkit or a strategy action plan that could be used in a lot of different locations. And with that, I want to thank you know, the opportunity to present this and open it up to any questions and comments.
Thank you so much, Mark and Matt, appreciate it. So we just heard about two really exciting projects, right? That could do some really good things from an equity standpoint, from a safety standpoint, from an economic and livability standpoint as well. So who might have questions? Starting off with the panel, Jerry.
Hi, good morning, folks. Great presentations all. Quick question, because there's a question in the chat pod too, but my question is, in considering the reconnection of these communities, are transit services or any kind of transportation services part of the mix of what you're considering?
I'll field that question for Greater Hartford Mobility Study. Definitely, we are looking into transit service improvements. As Commissioner Euclido mentioned, accessibility is not just connecting neighborhoods with other neighborhoods or connecting neighborhoods with parks and riverfront, right? It is also creating those opportunities for more people to have access to jobs and so that they have more options, right? So for Greater Hartford Mobility Study, we are looking into transit options, transit improvement options, which are focused on both expanding the existing transit infrastructure, but also in terms of operation. We are looking into providing evening service, right? Extending basically service hours for certain routes which have access to some of the key employment centers, right? Or also looking into improving the frequency or headway on certain routes where there are opportunities for providing transit as basically redundant alternative or mode to a highway solution, right? So these are definitely being looked at as part of solutions for Greater Hartford Mobility Study, and it's not just focused on highway-centric solutions.
Thank you.
And Jerry, this is Mark. I think for the Naugatuck Route 8, transit is probably less of a something we're going to be looking at. A number of these communities are small and don't really support fixed route systems and things like that. And I think the focus is going to be more on how we can get people to walk or bike underneath or through these areas to reconnect areas, across the swath of the highway. I know in Bridgeport, there's a very, it's a very extensive bus system. So there's a lot of transit already available in Bridgeport that keep people from, point A to point B. But again, I think the focus for us, and again, speaking for Naugatuck Valley, is the mobility of people or using, non-traditional transportation, not necessarily transit.
Just quickly add another thing that creates a lot of concerns or constraints for transit use is that first mile or last mile connection, right? And that's where basically, we need to have focus on micromobility options and creating those opportunities to have options to connect residential neighborhoods and like employment centers with those transit nodes more effectively. And Greater Hartford Mobility Study is also looking into focusing on that and creating safe sidewalk connections, safe connections to transit nodes and bus stops, and making sure that that will encourage overall transit use for the region.
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry, for your good question, and to our panelists for your responses. I think we have time for one more question, and we'll take it from the chat from Jeff Otto. And Jeff asks, and this is specific to the Greater Hartford Mobility Study. If I heard you correctly, you mentioned that capping a portion of I-84 north of downtown Hartford had led to disappointing results, mostly surface parking and dead spaces. When was the capping done and why? What were your goals? And I'd be interested in your thoughts on why that capping doesn't appear to have added value to the surrounding communities. Good question from Jeff.
Yeah, so I'll have to go back on when was it created, and we'll get that answer to you. But I think one of the reasons why that capping is not working is, or not working effectively, I shouldn't say that is not working, but it's not working effectively, is what is the purpose that capping is doing to connect communities? Like as Chris showed on the photo or the screenshot, is most of that is being used as parking lots, right? And it is not creating access for pedestrian friendly or bicycle friendly access across 84. And that's why basically it has limited effectiveness on it. So when you are looking for a capping for a limited section or for like what we are looking into in Greater Hartford Mobility Study as a lowered highway for I-84 or like creating a river access boulevard for connecting downtown with the riverfront, is how it can be more focused on multimodal connections. Can we create pedestrian linkages? Can we create bicycle linkages for that capping so that it's not just basically traversing automobile traffic across that connection, but also creating opportunities, complete street opportunities for all possible modes to have that connection across that capping, right? So I think one of the ways why the one that was showed is not very effective is that is not taking into consideration access for pedestrian bicycles and active transportation. It just focused on basically getting the cars across and using it as basically space for parking lots.
Thank you, Mayuresh, for your good response there, and Jeffrey for the question. So how about a big round of virtual applause to our presenters here. Again, two really exciting projects. Thank you to both teams so much, and we're looking forward to hearing more. All right. Thank you. So we'll now move on to the next portion of our agenda, which is the public participation component. And Mark Nielsen's going to handle that. And Mark, I'm not sure we have anyone on the line at this point in time. We did have someone earlier. I understand he had to leave the meeting, but I'll turn the floor over to you anyhow.
Okay, thanks, Matt. Just very quickly, we did ask people if they wanted to speak or to make a comment to the MAP forum. This was the opportunity to do so. We did ask people to pre-register so we knew who who was going to be coming on. So I'll just ask if there's anybody who is online that would like to address the MAP forum. Please identify yourself, and I guess we can unmute and listen to your comments. Do we have anybody? Going once, going twice. All right. We're available at any time. So anybody who is on the meeting, if you do have any questions that come up or think of something later, please do not hesitate to reach out to anybody who is part of the MAP forum. We're always available to discuss anything with public or other peers. So feel free. This isn't your only opportunity to address us. We're available at all times to answer your questions or provide information. So I guess that's it, Matt. On to you. Back to you.
Thanks, Mark. So we're now going to move on to the next item on our agenda, and we're going to receive staff reports from four of our working groups and also talk here about the development of our MAP forum hub. So let's start off with a report from the Multi-State Freight Working Group, and that report will be provided by Ann Strauss-Weider. Ann, welcome.
Thank you. I will share my screen. Give me a moment. Just doing a check that everyone can see the screen.
Looks great, Ann.
Okay. Thank you again, Matt. The Multi-State Freight Working Group provides a forum for discussing key issues and trends and considerations and collaboration among our respective organizations. Now, why do we do this? Well, because we're in a rapidly evolving situation in terms of freight movement and supply chains, particularly now coming out of the pandemic. And several examples of that. First of all, on this slide here, this is what's happening at the Port of New York and New Jersey, which at one point last year was the largest container port in North America. Right now it's sitting at the second largest in North America, but only about 100,000 TEUs or 20-foot containers behind Los Angeles. But this graph shows you just how things are rapidly evolving. The green line is 2019, a relatively typical year with seasonality. The blue line is 2020, the pandemic, when there were canceled sailings because facilities were closed, and then a huge surge as facilities came back online. The yellow was 2021, the fits and starts that we all experienced with backlogs and all sorts of demand trying to work its way through. The red line is 2022, where the port experienced a nearly 2 million TEU increase in volume over 2019. Way above where we were, and you can see no seasonality, huge demand, and then the red line slopes down at the end of the year because the super cycle, that filling of all that backlogged orders, consumer demand, essentially came to an end. The black line is where we are in 2023. So yes, it's gone down a bit to where we were in 2019, but it's coming back up again. Seasonality isn't there yet, and actually all the ports in the country have been experiencing this kind of change going on, less so here in New York than on the West Coast. So we're all going to be looking at what volumes are coming in here because of what that means for our region. And in terms of that rapidly evolving context, first of all, that super cycle being over, there are declines in freight rates heading back to the 2019 levels, And that also goes for industrial space. In many respects, we're now in an overbuild situation with more buildings coming empty to market, speculative construction. In the NJTPA area, there is new construction going on. It's primarily in smaller buildings where there's a big demand still for those properties. We're seeing increased use and accommodations for alternatively fueled equipment. Both, you know, some of you may see the Rivian Prime trucks now in the neighborhood, or there are now some electric drayage trucks down at the port, or the industrial developers are now including additional hookups at their new facilities. One thing I will mention from the private sector, based on what they're seeing, they do anticipate a turnaround in, they're hoping for a turnaround in the economy and freight movement as we enter the second part of this year. And to give you some idea of just how rapidly, I mean, how many of us thought about online grocery shopping before the pandemic or buy online and pick up at store? And already the private sector not only adapted to that, but they've already figured out ahead of us of how that's breaking out among different companies and what that means in terms of freight delivery, all of which we have to consider when we talk about what's happening in freight movement, both long distance move and shorter distance move. So what are we doing as the multi-state group? First of all, on March 23rd, we did a workshop, NJTPA hosted this on behalf of the MAP Forum, on offshore wind development that's going on across all our coasts, kind of a once-in-a-lifetime new industry developing here with major implications for us. We had great attendance. Many thanks. It was a group effort to get the best from Connecticut and New York and New Jersey to speak about exactly what's happening in the respective states and what that means, as well as from the federal government in that regard. Shameless plug, you can go to the MAP Forum website. The link is on the bottom of the screen. And you can see the presentations and listen to the recording from the workshop. So what's upcoming? NIMTIC will be hosting a workshop in the fall focused on regional waste movement. Jerry can provide more details as that develops. And potentially a facility visit for the Multi-State Freight Working Group members in Lehigh Valley, which has a huge amount of industrial development. That's possible, but still, since the pandemic, it is very difficult to get into facilities. So more to come on that. So at that point, Matt, I turn it back to you, and that ends my report, and I'll ask if there are any questions.
Thank you so much, Anne. I would suggest we hold off on questions until after we get all four reports, but thank you so much for your comprehensive work there. Why don't we next turn to Megan Sloan from MetroCog, and she's going to provide an update from the Multi-State Resilience Working Group. Megan?
Good morning, everybody. I'd like to share my screen. Is that okay?
Should be, Laura.
Great. Okay, so this is just a quick update. We're having a meeting on June 13th, and I'll discuss that a little bit further. But in February, we had a great presentation at our meeting, February 13th, Mukta Ramallah presented a review and evaluation of the post-Hurricane Sandy Transportation Resilience Study. She reviewed all of the data sources that were used, as well as new data sources that are available since the study has been finalized. And she also provided excellent examples of how national, state, local, and regional tools are being used currently. So for our upcoming meeting in June, we're going to focus on how do MPOs throughout the MAP Forum region plan for resilience. Manesh, my co-chair and I, we've met a few times to start reviewing the post-Sandy data sources and comparing and looking at how they've been updated. Since the study completed in 2017, there's been a lot of work done at the national level. For example, FEMA maps are regularly updated. NOAA data is evolving. And then there's new data sources as well. For example, EV and alternative charging stations and different freight facilities. So that's going to be the focus of next week's meeting or the week after next. And as everybody here is probably familiar, the Protect Discretionary Grant has been announced, and I'm sure that's going to be of interest to members too. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Megan. We appreciate the good work your team is focused on as well. Next, why don't we turn to Jerry Bogaz for a report from the Metropolitan Mobility Network.
Thanks, Matt. And I'm going to do this without any visuals and do it quickly, hopefully. The network actually predates the BAP form. It was created initially by NIMTIC as an advisory working group back in the late 1990s. And its initial focus was on demand management and coordinating demand management activities within the NIMTIC planning area. But over time, that got expanded out and it became wrapped into the MAP forum, a texture of looking at things on a multi-state level. In 2019, we were holding meetings in the network and focused on issues like how ITS, intelligent transportation systems, and transit were coming together, some of the technological advances in terms of transit data and information, public information from transit, and you know, beginning a discussion of transportation network companies and how they could be best integrated into the mix of transportation services. During the pandemic in 2020 and 2021, the network did not meet formally, although there were discussions amongst various MPO members. But then in 2022, we reconstituted the network and began to focus on areas where had increased in prominence due to the pandemic, things like mobility as a service, which we had an excellent 2022 presentation from an organization called Move PGH in Pittsburgh that's bringing together mobility as a service in a large area of the Pittsburgh metropolitan region. Most recently, we had a meeting on May 3rd, and in that meeting, we had a report from the Eastern Transportation Coalition about their very good work looking at road user charges, both as a demand management tool and as a financial tool. And we heard from New York State and Connecticut, the state of Connecticut, about transportation systems management and operations expansions in New York State and plans in New York State and Connecticut. So the network is much more focused now on the broader area of transportation systems management and operations, which does include demand management, but obviously has a big component of systems management and transit management as part of it. So we will continue to have, we may be having a fall meeting this year, but if that doesn't come together, certainly we will be back in the spring of 2024 with our next session. And by the way, the network is not only the MPOs and COGS in the MAP form, but also it does attempt to bring in nonprofit organizations that are doing this type of work, agencies that are involved in all kinds of different demand management and operational activities. And so it is a broader discussion than simply the members of the MAP forum, but the members of the MAP forum are, you know, sharing this information and learning from it. And that's where the network aspect of the Metropolitan Mobility Network really comes to play. So it is advising policy in the multi-state region. So happy to answer any questions if anyone has any, and thanks for the opportunity to report back.
Thanks very much, Jerry. Appreciate that. So last but certainly not least, we want to hear from Richard and Gabrielle from the NJTPA regarding their group's work on the hub.
Good morning, everyone. Maybe I'll share, if possible, I'd like to share the screen just to give, for those folks who haven't seen the hub, you know, just give them a quick glance at it. Can everyone see it?
Yes.
Great. So Gabrielle's also on the call. She'll, if there's any technical questions on the hub, she'll be able to answer. But I'll just give you an overview real quick about what's been happening. Right now, it's a pretty stable product. We have our working groups here, and any updates that come in from the working groups, whether it's, you know, study information or different session, different items that they would like posted, we put them on the site. And yeah, you can, so, and then, you know, we also post upcoming events, and we always mention that any MAP Forum member, if they would like any events that they would like publicized to the region, please let us know and send myself or Gabrielle an email, and we'll be able to post it on. And, you know, we've all, and some folks and the MAP Forum have ability and they have rights to actually publish on here. So they do have user rights on it. But if not, you can send it to us. We have a few items here you can see. And we have, you know, what new section. The big thing here is for a long time, we had a COVID page on here with, you know, updating COVID information. And, you know, now it's a time we recently stopped publishing that. And we're looking at this new section here. It's called Cross MPO Projects. And, you know, we're working with Jerry on that. So the idea here is members of the MAP Forum would send us and send it to Jerry information on projects in your tip that cross MPO boundaries. And we our idea is then first to create a map, and not like this, but we create a map, an interactive map with these projects. And then the idea is underneath, we would have text and information that the MAP Forum members would like displayed about those particular projects. And Jerry, you may want to add a little bit more on that, because this was your idea.
Well, it certainly goes back before me having the idea, but essentially what we'd done early on in the MAP Forum is to identify, as Rick said, these cross-boundary projects and studies that have impacts in more than one MPO, and there are many examples of them. And we're trying to update that information. We actually have a written section that's in some of our plans that describes that in a larger multi-state region. So that would just be translating that information into what Rick has described, and then using the website as a way to tie together information about those projects. In a similar way that we've done, Rick, when you scroll down to the map of the region, and you can hover over individual MPOs and get links to their various planning documents.
Yeah.
Again, it's amplifying the MAP Forum as a network for information sharing.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing. So we would put this information on the map, and what, and text and everything else underneath it here in this section. And then there'll be linkages, if you want, back to the site, a site that you would like on your own member websites. So, and that's it. So again, we're always looking to improve, and we always welcome ideas. If there's any other ideas about different items that you'd like to display on the site, just let us know. So, and I'll stop sharing.
Thank you so much, Richard. And it looks like we all need to add the hub to our favorites bar, right? If we haven't already, I'll certainly do that.
Thanks.
Okay. So who has questions? Who has questions for Anne, Megan, Jerry, Richard, and Gabrielle? Anyone? All right. I've got a quick one for Anne. Anne, you touched on, I think, an upcoming workshop related to the movement of waste product. I know that's certainly an issue for Connecticut, and I imagine the other states as well. Could you elaborate a little bit on the group's work on that issue to date?
In this case, I'm going to defer over to Jerry, because I believe that NIMTIC has a study just getting underway.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Matt, it's called the Regional Waste Movement Study, and it's funded through NIMTIC, but it's intended to cover the entire multi-state region. It is just getting underway. We're finalizing some contractual arrangements. We hope to kick it off if not over the summer, then certainly in early September. And the idea that was floated with the multi-state freight working group was to have that workshop, to schedule one in the fall as a component of the overall kickoff of the study. And we've heard, and it was a multi-state team that actually helped us with the scoping of the study. And so we are aware that there are waste issues all over the place, including Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, some big issues on Long Island. So that's one of the reasons that this study was brought together and was recommended in various planning documents.
Thank you very much, Jerry and Ann, and looking forward to that study. Any other questions for the working groups? All right, not hearing or seeing everyone any, I really want to thank our colleagues for their thorough reports today, as well as the members of all of the working groups for their efforts all year round. And as we can see, you know, they're doing a lot of very good work on our behalf. So as we move to wrap up today, I'd like to once again thank our guest speakers and panelists. It was wonderful to have the commissioner on earlier and hear about those two exciting projects in Connecticut. I'd also like to thank the members of our planning team, Jerry and Mark and Kara Radzins and Laura Rosenbluth from CROG. Big round of applause for them and all their hard work in putting this event together today. We really appreciate it. Our next MAP Forum meeting will be held will be our annual meeting in December, and date and time to be determined. And Jerry, was there a note regarding the NJTPA hosting an upcoming meeting?
Yes, it's their turn, Matt. So they would be hosting the annual meeting in December.
Okay, great. So we're looking forward to that. And then last but certainly not least, want to ask the members if you have any suggested agenda items for that annual meeting. And if you don't have them today, you know how to reach Jerry. Okay, not hearing any. I want to thank everyone for attending today. Thought it was a very productive meeting. Really appreciate the discussion, hearing more about these the projects and the good work we're doing. Want to wish everyone a wonderful summer and look forward to seeing you online again soon. Take care, everyone.
All right. Thank you, Matt, for hosting. Did a great
job. Matt. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.